properly. But no sooner was my back turned than Benedetto became master, and everything went ill. When he was only 11, he chose his companions from among the young men of 18 or 20, the worst characters in Bastia, or indeed in Corsica, and they had already, for some pieces of mischief, been several times threatened with a prosecution. I became alarmed, as any prosecution might be attended with serious consequences. I was compelled, at this period, to leave Corsica on an important expedition. I reflected for a long time, and with the hope of averting some impending misfortune, I resolved that Benedetto should accompany me. I hoped that the active and laborious life of a smuggler, with the severe discipline on board, would have a salutary effect on his character, well nigh, if not quite, corrupt. I spoke to Benedetto alone, and proposed to him to accompany me, endeavouring to tempt him by all the promises most likely to dazzle the imagination of a child of 12 years old. He heard me patiently, and when I had finished, burst out laughing. "Are you mad, uncle?" He called me by this name when he was in a good humour. "Do you think I am going to change the life I lead for your mode of existence, my agreeable indolence for the hard and precarious toil you impose on yourself? Exposed to the bitter frost at night and the scorching heat by day, compelled to conceal yourself, and when you are perceived, receive a volley of balls, and all to earn a paltry sum? Why, I have as much money as I want. Mother Assunta always furnishes me when I ask for it. You see that I should be a fool to accept your offer." The arguments and this audacity perfectly stupefied me. Benedetto rejoined his associates, and I saw him from a distance point me out to them as a fool. "Sweet child," murmured Monte Cristo. "Oh, had he been my own son," replied Bertuccio, "or even my nephew, I would have brought him back to the right road, for the knowledge that you are doing your duty gives you strength. But the idea that I was striking a child whose father I had killed made it impossible for me to punish him. I gave my sister, who constantly defended the unfortunate boy, good advice, and as she confessed that she had several times missed money to a considerable amount, I showed her a safe place in which to conceal our little treasure for the future. My mind was already made up. Benedetto could read, write, and cipher perfectly, for when the fit seized him, he learned more in a day than others in a week. My intention was to enter him as clerk in some ship, and without letting him know anything of my plan, to convey him some morning on board. By this means, his future treatment would depend upon his own conduct. I set off for France after having fixed upon this plan. All our cargo was to be landed in the Gulf of Lyon, and this was the more difficult because it was then the year 1829. The most perfect tranquillity was restored, and the vigilance of the custom-house officers was redoubled, and this strictness was increased at this time in consequence of the fair of Beaucaire. Our expedition commenced favourably. We anchored our bark, which had a double hold, where our goods were concealed, amidst a number of other vessels that bordered the banks of the Rhone from Beaucaire to Arles. On our arrival there, we began to discharge our cargo in the night, and to convey it into the town, by help of the innkeeper with whom we were connected. Whether success rendered us imprudent, or whether we were betrayed, I know not. But one evening, about 5 o'clock, our little cabin-boy hastened breathless to inform us that he had seen a detachment of custom-house officers advancing in our direction. It was not their proximity that alarmed us, for detachments were constantly patrolling along the banks of the Rhone, but the care, according to the boy's account, they took to avoid being seen. In an instant we were on the alert, but it was too late. Our vessel was surrounded, and amongst the custom-house officers I observed several gendarmes, and, as terrified at the sight of their uniforms as I was brave at the sight of any other, I sprang into the hold, opened a port, and dropped into the river, dived, and only rose at intervals to breathe, until I reached a cutting that led from the Rhone to the canal that runs from Beaucaire to Aigues-Mortes. I was now safe, for I could swim along the cutting without being seen, and I reached the canal in safety. I had designedly taken this direction. I have already told your excellency of an innkeeper of Nîmes who had set up a little inn on the road from Bellegarde to Beaucaire. Yes, said Monte Cristo, I perfectly recollect him. I think he was your colleague? Precisely, answered Bertuccio. But he had, 7 or 8 years before this period, sold his establishment to a tailor at Marseille, who, having almost ruined himself in his old trade, wished to make his fortune in another. Of course, we made the same arrangements with the new landlord that we have with the old, and it was of this man that I intended to ask shelter. What was his name? Inquired the Count, who seemed to become somewhat interested in Bertuccio's story. Gaspar Caderousse. He had married a woman from the village of Carconte, and whom we did not know by any other name than that of her village. She was suffering from the marsh fever, and seemed dying by inches. As for her husband, he was a strapping fellow of 40 or 45, who had more than once in time of danger given ample proof of his presence of mind and courage. And you say, interrupted Monte Cristo, that this took place towards the year 1829, Monsieur Lecomte. In what month? June. The beginning or the end? The evening of the 3rd. Ah, said Monte Cristo. The evening of the 3rd of June, 1829. Go on. It was from Caderousse that I intended demanding shelter, and as we never entered by the door that opened onto the road, I resolved not to break through the rule, and climbing over the garden hedge, I crept amongst the olive and wild fig trees, and fearing that Caderousse might have someone there, I entered a kind of shed in which I had often passed the night, and which was only separated from the inn by a partition, in which holes had been made in order to enable us to watch an opportunity of announcing our presence. My intention was, if Caderousse was alone, to acquaint him with my presence, finish the meal the custom-house officers had interrupted, and profit by the threatened storm to return to the Rhône and ascertain the state of our vessel and its crew. I stepped into the shed, and it was fortunate I did so, for at that moment Caderousse entered with a stranger. I waited patiently, not to overhear what they said, but because I could do nothing else. Besides, the same thing had occurred often before. The man who was with Caderousse was evidently a stranger to the south of France. He was one of those merchants who come to sell jewellery at the fair of Beaucaire, and who, during the month the fair lasts, and during which there is so great an influx of merchants and customers from all parts of Europe, often have dealings to the amount of 100,000 to 150,000 francs, £4,000 to £6,000. Caderousse entered hastily. Then, seeing that the room was, as usual, empty and only guarded by the dog, he called to his wife. "Hilloa, Carconte," said he, "the worthy priest has not deceived us. The diamond is real." An exclamation of joy was heard, and the staircase creaked beneath a feeble step. "What do you say?" asked his wife, pale as death. "I say that the diamond is real, and that this gentleman, one of the first jewellers of Paris, will give us 50,000 francs for it, £2,000. Only in order to satisfy himself it really belongs to us, he wishes you to relate to him, as I have done already, the miraculous manner in which the diamond came into our possession. In the meantime, please to sit down, monsieur, and I will fetch you some refreshment." The jeweller examined attentively the interior of the inn and the visible poverty of the persons who were about to sell him a diamond that seemed to have come from the casket of a prince. "Relate your story, madame," said he, wishing, no doubt, to profit by the absence of the husband, so that the latter could not influence the wife's story, to see if the two recitals tallied. "Oh," returned she, "it was a gift of heaven. My husband was a great friend in 1814 or 1815 of a sailor named Edmund Dantès. This poor fellow, whom Caderousse had forgotten, had not forgotten him, and at his death bequeathed this diamond to him." "But how did he obtain it?" asked the jeweller. "Had he it before he was imprisoned?" No, monsieur, but it appears that in prison he made the acquaintance of a rich Englishman, and as in prison he fell sick and Dantès took the same care of him as if he had been his brother, the Englishman, when he was set free, gave this stone to Dantès, who, less fortunate, died, and in his turn left it to us, and charged the excellent abbé, who was here this morning, to deliver it. The same story, muttered the jeweller, and improbable as it seems at first, the history may be true. There's only the price we are not agreed about. How not agreed about? Said Caderousse. I thought we agreed for the price I asked. That is, replied the jeweller, I offered 40,000 francs. 40,000? Cried La Carconte. We will not part with it for that sum. The abbé told us it was worth 50,000 without the setting. What was the abbé's name? Asked the indefatigable questioner. The abbé Busoni, said La Carconte. He was a foreigner? An Italian from the neighbourhood of Mantua, I believe. Let me see this diamond again, replied the jeweller. The first time you are often mistaken as to the value of a stone. Caderousse took from his pocket a small case of black shagreen, opened and gave it to the jeweller. At the sight of the diamond, which was as large as a hazelnut, La Carconte's eyes sparkled with cupidity.
"'And what did you think of this fine story, eavesdropper?' said Monte Cristo. "'Did you credit it?'
"'Yes, Your Excellency. "'I did not look on Caderousse as a bad man, "'and I thought him incapable of committing a crime or even a theft. "'That did more honour to your heart than to your experience, Monsieur Bertuccio. "'Had you known this Edmond Dantès, of whom they spoke. Now, Your Excellency, I had never heard of him before, and never but once afterwards, and that was from the Abbé Busoni himself, when I saw him in the prison at Nîmes. Go on. The jeweller took the ring, and drawing from his pocket a pair of steel pliers and a small set of copper scales, he took the stone out of its setting and weighed it carefully.
"'I will give you 45,000,' said he, "'but not a halfpenny more. "'Besides, as that is the exact value of the stone, "'I brought just that sum with me.'
"'Oh, that's no matter,' replied Caderousse. "'I will go back with you to fetch the other 5,000 francs.'
"'No,' returned the jeweller, "'giving back the diamond and the ring to Caderousse. "'No, it is worth no more, and I am sorry I offered so much, "'for the stone has a flaw in it, which I had not seen. "'However, I will not go from my word, and I will give 45,000.'
"'At least replace the diamond in the ring,' said Carconte, sharply.
"'Ah, true,' replied the jeweller, and he reset the stone.'
"'No matter,' observed Caderousse, replacing the box in his pocket. "'Someone else will purchase it.'
"'Yes,' continued the jeweller, "'but someone else will not be so easy as I am, "'or content himself with the same story. "'It is not natural that a man like you should possess such a diamond. "'He will inform against you. "'You will have to find the Abbé Busoni, "'and abbés who give diamonds worth 2,000 louis are rare.' Justice will seize it and put you in prison. If at the end of 3 or 4 months you are set at liberty, the ring will be lost, or a false stone worth 3 francs will be given you instead of a diamond worth 50,000 or perhaps 55,000 francs, but which you must allow one runs considerable risk in purchasing.
Caderousse and his wife looked eagerly at each other. No, said Caderousse, we are not rich enough to lose 500 francs.
"'As you please, my dear sir,' said the jeweller. "'I had, however, as you see, brought you the money in bright coin, "'and he drew from his pocket a handful of gold, "'which he made to sparkle in the dazzled eyes of the innkeeper, "'and in the other hand he held a packet of banknotes. "'There was evidently a severe struggle in the mind of Caderousse. "'It was evident that the small shagreen case which he turned and returned in his hand did not seem to him commensurate in value to the enormous sum which fascinated his gaze. He turned towards his wife. "'What do you think of this?' he asked in a low voice. "'Let him have it. Let him have it,' she said. "'If he returns to Beaucaire without the diamond, he will inform against us. "'And, as he says, who knows if we shall ever again see the Abbé Busoni. "'In all probability we shall never see him.
Well then, so I will, said Caderousse. So you may have the diamond for 45,000 francs. But my wife wants a gold chain, and I want a pair of silver buckles. The jeweller drew from his pocket a long flat box, which contained several samples of the articles demanded. Here, he said, I am very plain in my dealings. Take your choice. The woman selected a gold chain worth about 5 louis, and the husband a pair of buckles worth perhaps 15 francs. I hope you will not complain now, said the jeweller. The abbé told me it was worth 50,000 francs, muttered Caderousse. Come, come, give it to me. What a strange fellow you are, said the jeweller, taking the diamond from his hand. I gave you 45,000 francs, that is 2,500 livres of income, a fortune such as I wish I had myself, and you are not satisfied. And the 45,000 francs, inquired Caderousse in a hoarse voice, where are they? Come, let us see them. Here they are, replied the jeweller, and he counted out upon the table 15,000 francs in gold and 30,000 francs in banknotes. Wait whilst I light the lamp, said Locquequart. It is growing dark, and there may be some mistake. In fact, night had come on during this conversation, and with night the storm which had been threatening for the last half hour. The thunder was heard growling in the distance, but neither the jeweller nor Caderousse nor Locquequart seemed to heed it, absorbed as they were all three with the demon of gain. I myself felt a strange kind of fascination at the sight of all this gold and all these banknotes. It seemed to me that I was in a dream, and, as it always happens in a dream, I felt myself riveted to the spot. Caderousse counted and again counted the gold and the notes, then handed them to his wife, who counted and counted then again in her turn. During this time the jeweller made the diamond play and sparkle beneath the ray of the lamp, and the gem threw out jets of light which made him unmindful of those which, precursors of the storm, began to play in at the windows. "Well," inquired the jeweller, "is the cash all right?" Yes, said Caderousse, give me the pocketbook, Locquequart, and find a bag somewhere. Locquequart went to a cupboard and returned with an old leathern pocketbook, from which he took some greasy letters and put in their place the banknotes, and a bag in which were, at the moment, 2 or 3 crowns of 6 livres each, and which, in all probability, formed the entire fortune of the miserable couple. There, said Caderousse, and now, although you have wronged us of perhaps 10,000 francs, will you have your supper with us? I invite you with good will. Thank you, replied the jeweller. It must be getting late, and I must return to Beaucaire. My wife will be getting uneasy. He drew out his watch and exclaimed, Morbleu! Nearly 9 o'clock. Why, I shall not get back to Beaucaire before midnight. Good night, my dears. If the Abbé Busoni should, by any accident, return, think of me. In another week you will have left Beaucaire, remarked Caderousse, for the fair finishes in a few days. True, but that is no consequence. Write to me at Paris, to Monsieur Joannis, in the Palais Royal, Stone Gallery, number 45. I will make the journey on purpose to see him, if it is worth while. At this moment there was a tremendous clap of thunder, accompanied by a flash of lightning so vivid that it quite eclipsed the light of the lamp. Oh, dear, exclaimed Caderousse, you cannot think of going out in such weather as this. Oh, I am not afraid of thunder, said the jeweller. And then there are robbers, said Locquequart. The road is never very safe during fair time. Oh, as to the robbers, said Joannis, here is something for them. And he drew from his pocket a pair of small pistols loaded to the muzzle. Here, said he, are dogs who bark and bite at the same time. They are for the 2 first who shall have a longing for your diamond, Daddy Caderousse. Caderousse and his wife again interchanged a meaning look. It seemed as though they were both inspired at the same time with some horrible thought. Well then, a good journey to you, said Caderousse. Thank ye, replied the jeweller. He then took his cane, which he had placed against an old cupboard, and went out. At the moment when he opened the door, such a gust of wind came in that the lamp was nearly extinguished. Oh, said he, this is very nice weather, and 2 leagues to go in such a storm. Remain, said Caderousse, you can sleep here.
Yes, do stay, added La Carconte in a tremulous voice. We will take every care of you. No, I must sleep at Beaucaire. So once more, good night. Caderousse followed him slowly to the threshold. I can neither see heaven nor earth, said the jeweller, who was outside the door. Do I turn to the right or left hand? To the right, said Caderousse. You cannot go wrong. The road is bordered by trees on both sides. Good. All right, said a voice almost lost in the distance. Close the door, said La Carconte. I do not like open doors when it thunders. Particularly when there is money in the house, eh? Answered Caderousse, double-locking the door. He came into the room, went to the cupboard, took out the bag and pocket-book, and both began for the third time to count their gold and banknotes. I never saw such an expression of cupidity as the flickering lamp revealed in the two countenances. The woman especially was hideous. The feverish tremulousness she usually had was redoubled. Her countenance had become livid, and her eyes resembled burning coals. Why, she inquired in a hoarse voice, did you invite him to sleep here tonight? Why? Said Caderousse with a shudder. Why, that he might not have the trouble of returning to Beaucaire. Ah, responded the woman, with an expression impossible to render. I thought it was for something else. Woman! Woman, why do you have such ideas? Cried Caderousse. Or, if you have them, why don't you keep them to yourself? Well, said La Carconte, after a moment's pause, you are not a man. What do you mean? Added Caderousse. If you had been a man, you would not have let him go from here. Woman! Or else he should not have reached Beaucaire. Woman! The road takes a turn. He is obliged to follow it, whilst alongside the canal there is a shorter road. Woman, you offend the bon Dieu. There, listen. And at this moment there was heard a tremendous peal of thunder, whilst the livid lightning illumined the room. And the thunder then rolling away to a distance seemed as though it left the cursed abode lingeringly. Mercy, said Caderousse, crossing himself. At the same moment, and in the midst of the silence so full of terror which usually follows claps of thunder, they heard a knocking at the door. Caderousse and his wife started and looked aghast at each other. Who's there? Cried Caderousse, rising, and drawing up in a heap the golden notes scattered over the table, and which he covered with his two hands. It is I, shouted a voice. And who are you? Eh, pardieu! Joannes, the jeweller. Well, and you said I offended the bon Dieu, said Carconte with a horrid smile. Why, it is the bon Dieu who sends him back again. Caderousse fell back, pale and breathless, in his chair. La Carconte, on the contrary, rose, and going with a firm step towards the door, opened it, saying as she did so, Come in, dear Monsieur Joannis. Ma foi, said the jeweller, drenched with rain, it seems as if I was not to return to Beaucaire tonight. The shortest follies are best, my dear Caderousse. You offered me hospitality, and I accept it, and have returned to sleep beneath your friendly roof. Caderousse stammered out some words, whilst he wiped away the damp that started to his brow. La Carconte double-locked the door behind the jeweller. 46. The Rain of Blood. As the jeweller returned to the apartment, he cast around him a scrutinizing glance, but there was nothing to excite suspicion if it existed not, or to confirm it if already awakened. Caderousse's hands still grasped his gold and banknotes, and La Carconte called up her sweetest smiles while welcoming the reappearance of their guest. "Heyday," said the jeweller, "you seem, my good friends, to have had some fears respecting the accuracy of your money by counting it over so carefully directly I was gone." "No, no," answered Caderousse, "that was not my reason, I can assure you, but the circumstances by which we have become possessed of this wealth are so unexpected as to make us scarcely credit our good fortune, and it is only by placing the actual proof of our riches before our eyes that we can persuade ourselves the whole affair is not a dream." The jeweller smiled.
"Have you any other guests in your house?" inquired he.
"Nobody but ourselves," replied Caderousse.
"The fact is, we do not lodge travellers. Indeed, our tavern is so near to the town that nobody would think of stopping here."
"Then I am afraid I shall very much inconvenience you."
"Oh, dear me, no. Indeed, good sir, you will not," said La Carconte in her most gracious manner.
"I vow and protest your passing the night under shelter of our poor roof will not make the slightest difference in the world to us. But where will you manage to stow me?"
"In the chamber overhead. Surely that is where you yourselves sleep.
Never mind that. We have a second bed in the adjoining room."
Caderousse stared at his wife with much astonishment.
The jeweller, meanwhile, was humming a song as he stood warming himself by the bright, cheering blaze of a large faggot kindled by the attentive Carconte to dry the wet garments of her guest. And this done, she next occupied herself in arranging his supper by spreading a napkin at the end of the table and placing on it the slender remains of their dinner, to which she added 3 or 4 fresh-laid eggs.
Caderousse had once more parted with his treasures. The banknotes were replaced in the pocket-book, the gold put back into the bag, and the whole carefully locked in the armoire, which formed his stronghold. He then commenced pacing the room with a pensive and gloomy air, glancing from time to time at the jeweller, who stood reeking with the steam from his wet clothes, and merely changing his place on the warm hearth to enable the whole of the garments to be in turn dried by the genial heat that issued from it.
"Now then, my dear sir," said La Carconte, as she placed a bottle of wine on the table, "supper is ready whenever you are inclined to partake of it."
"But you are going to sit down with me, are you not?" asked Joannis.
"I shall not take any supper to-night," said Caderousse.
"We dine so very late," hastily interposed La Carconte.
"Then it seems I am to eat alone," remarked the jeweller.
"Oh, we shall have the pleasure of waiting upon you," answered La Carconte, with an eager attention she was not accustomed to manifest, even to guests who paid for what they took. From one minute to another, Caderousse darted on his wife keen, searching glances, but rapid as the lightning flash. The storm still continued.
"There, there," said La Carconte, "do you hear that? Upon my word, you did well to return hither."
"Nevertheless," replied the jeweller, "if by the time I have finished my supper the tempest has at all abated, I shall make another attempt to complete my journey."
"Oh," said Caderousse, shaking his head, "there is not the slightest chance of its abating. It is the mistral, and that will be sure to last till tomorrow morning."
He then sighed heavily.
"Well," said the jeweller, as he placed himself at table, "all I can say is, so much the worse for those who are abroad and cannot obtain a shelter."
"Ah," chimed in La Carconte, "they will have a wretched night of it, be they who they may."
The jeweller commenced eating his supper, and the woman, who was ordinarily so querulous and indifferent to all who approached her, was suddenly transformed into the most smiling and attentive hostess. Had the unhappy man on whom she lavished her assiduities been previously acquainted with her, so sudden an alteration might well have excited suspicion in his mind, or at least have greatly astonished him. Caderousse, meanwhile, continued in gloomy silence to pace the room, sedulously avoiding the sight of his guest, but as soon as the stranger had completed his repast, the agitated innkeeper went eagerly to the door and opened it.
"The storm seems over," said he.
But as if to contradict his statement, at that instant a violent clap of thunder seemed to shake the house to its very foundation, while a sudden gust of wind, mingled with rain, extinguished the lamp he held in his hand. Trembling and awestruck, Caderousse hastily shut the door and returned to his guest, while La Carconte lighted a candle by the smouldering ashes that glimmered on the hearth.
"You must be tired," said she to the jeweller. "I have spread a pair of my finest and whitest sheets on your bed, so you have nothing to do but to sleep as soundly as I wish you may. You can easily find your room. It is exactly over this."
Joannis remained a short time listening whether the storm seemed to abate in its fury, but a brief space of time sufficed to assure him that, far from diminishing, the violence of the rain and thunder momentarily increased. Resigning himself, therefore, to what seemed inevitable, he bade his host good night and mounted to his sleeping apartment. As he passed over my head, the flooring seemed to creak beneath his tread, proving how slight must be the division between us. The quick, eager glance of La Carconte followed him as he ascended the staircase, while Caderousse, on the contrary, turned his back and seemed most anxiously to avoid even glancing at him. All these particulars did not strike me as painfully at the time as they have since done. In fact, all that had happened, with the exception of the story of the diamond, which certainly did wear an air of improbability, appeared natural enough, and called for neither apprehension nor mistrust. But worn out as I was with fatigue, and fully purposing to proceed onwards directly the tempest abated, I determined to take advantage of the comparative silence and tranquillity that prevailed to obtain the refreshment of a few hours' sleep. Overhead, I could accurately distinguish every movement of the jeweller, who, after making the best arrangements in his power for passing a comfortable night, threw himself on his bed, and I could hear it creak and groan beneath his weight. Insensibly, my eyelids grew heavy. Deep sleep stole over me, and having no suspicion of anything wrong, I sought not to shake it off. For the last time, I looked in upon the room where Caderousse and his wife were sitting. The former was seated upon one of those low wooden stools which, in country places, are frequently used instead of chairs. His back, being turned towards me, prevented me from seeing the expression of his countenance. Neither should I have been able to do so had he been placed differently, as his head was buried between his two hands. La Carconte continued to gaze on him for some time in contemptuous silence. Then, shrugging up her shoulders, she took her seat immediately opposite to him. At this moment, the expiring embers threw up a fresh flame from the kindling of a piece of wood that lay near, and a bright gleam was thrown on the scene and the actors in it. La Carconte still kept her eyes fixed on her husband, but as he made no sign of changing his position, she extended her hard, bony hand and touched him on the forehead. Caderousse shuddered. The woman's lips seemed to move as though she were talking, but whether she merely spoke in an undertone or that my senses were dulled by sleep, I did not catch a word she uttered. Confused sights and sounds seemed to float before me, and gradually I fell into a deep, heavy sleep. How long I had been in this unconscious state I know not, when I was suddenly aroused by the report of a pistol, followed by a fearful cry. Weak and tottering footsteps resounded across the chamber above me, and the next instant a dull, heavy weight seemed to fall powerless on the staircase. I had not yet fully recovered my recollection when again I heard groans, mingled with half-stifled cries, as if from persons engaged in a deadly struggle. These evidences of the perpetration of some violent deed effectually roused me from my drowsy lethargy. Hastily raising myself on one arm, I looked around, but all was dark, and it seemed to me as if the rain must have penetrated through the flooring of the room above, for some kind of moisture appeared to fall drop by drop upon my forehead, and when I passed my hand across my brow, I felt it wet and clammy. To the fearful noises that had awakened me had succeeded the most perfect silence, unbroken save by the footsteps of a man walking about in the chamber above. By the creaking of the staircase, I judged the individual, whoever he was proceeding to the lower apartment. In another minute, I heard some person moving there, and looking through, I saw a man stooping towards the fire to light a candle he held in his hand. As he turned round, I recognized the features of Caderousse, pale, ghastly, and convulsed, while the front and sleeves of his dress were covered with blood. Having obtained the light he had evidently descended to seek, he hurried upstairs again, and once more I heard his rapid and uneasy step in the chamber above. Ere long he came below, holding in his hand the small shagreen case, which he opened to assure himself it contained the diamond, seemed to hesitate as to which pocket he should put it in. Then, as if dissatisfied with the security of either pocket, he deposited it in his red handkerchief, which he carefully rolled round his head. After this he took from his cupboard the banknotes and gold he had put there, thrust the one in the pocket of his trousers and the other into that of his waistcoat, hastily tied up a small bundle of linen, and rushing towards the door, disappeared in the darkness of the night. Then all became clear and manifest to me, and I reproached myself with what had happened, as though I myself had done the guilty deed. I fancied that I still heard faint moans, and imagining that the unfortunate jeweller might not be quite dead, I determined to go to his relief, by way of atoning in some slight degree not for the crime I had committed, but for that which I had not endeavoured to prevent. For this purpose I applied all the strength I possessed to force an entrance from the cramped spot in which I lay to the adjoining room. The badly arranged planks which alone divided me from it yielded to my efforts, and I found myself in the house. Hastily snatching up the lighted candle, I hurried to the staircase. Towards the middle of it, I stumbled over a human body lying quite across the stairs. As I stooped to raise it, I discovered in the agonized features those of La Carconte. The pistol, I had heard, had doubtless been discharged at the unfortunate woman, whose throat it had frightfully lacerated, leaving a gaping wound from which, as well as the mouth, the blood was welling in sanguinary streams. Finding the miserable creature past all human aid, I strode past her and ascended to the sleeping chamber, which presented an appearance of the wildest disorder. The furniture had been knocked over in the deadly struggle that had taken place there, and the sheets to which the unfortunate jeweller had doubtless clung were dragged across the room. The murdered man lay on the ground, his head leaning against the wall, weltering in a gory stream poured forth from three large wounds in his breast. There was a fourth gash, but the blood was prevented escaping in consequence of the weapon, a large table knife, still sticking in it. I stumbled over some object I stooped to examine. It was the second pistol, which had not gone off, probably from the powder being wet. I approached the jeweller, who was not quite dead, and at the sound of my footsteps, causing as they did the creaking of the floor, he opened his eyes, fixed them on me with an anxious and inquiring gaze, moved his lips as though trying to speak, then, overcome by the effort, fell back and expired. This appalling sight almost bereft me of my senses, and finding that I could no longer be of service to anyone in the house, my only desire was to fly from such an accumulation of horrors as quickly as I could. Almost distracted, I rushed towards the staircase, clasping my burning temples with both hands and uttering cries of horror. Upon reaching the room below, I found five or six custom house officers, accompanied by an armed troop of soldiery, who immediately seized me ere, indeed, I had sufficiently collected my ideas to offer any resistance. In truth, my senses seemed to have wholly forsaken me, and when I strove to speak, a few inarticulate sounds alone escaped my lips. As I noticed the significant manner in which the whole party pointed to my blood-stained garments, I involuntarily surveyed myself, and then I discovered that the thick, warm drops that had so bedewed me as I lay beneath the staircase must have been the blood of La Carconte. Paralyzed with horror, I could barely indicate by a movement of my hand the spot where I had concealed myself. "What does he mean?" asked a gendarme. One of the officers went to the place I directed. "He means," replied the man upon his return, "that he effected his entrance by means of this hole," showing the place where I had broken my way through the planks into the house. Then, and not before, the true nature of my situation flashed on me, and I saw that I was considered the guilty author of all that had occurred. With this frightful conviction of my danger, I recovered force and energy enough to free myself from the hands of those who held me, while I managed to stammer forth, "I did not do it, indeed, indeed I did not." A couple of gendarmes held the muzzles of their carbines against my breast. "Stir but a step," said they, "and you are a dead man." "Why should you threaten me with death," cried I, "when I have already declared my innocence?" "Tush, tush," cried the men, "keep your innocent stories to tell to the judge at Nîmes. Meanwhile, come along with us, and the best advice we can give you is to do so unresistingly." Alas, resistance was far from my thoughts. I was utterly overpowered by surprise and terror, and without a word I suffered myself to be handcuffed and tied to a horse's tail, in which disgraceful plight I arrived at Nîmes. It seems I had been tracked by an officer who had lost sight of me near the tavern. Feeling assured that I intended to pass the night there, he had returned to summon his comrades, who just arrived in time to hear the report of the pistol and to take me in the midst of such circumstantial proofs of my guilt as rendered all hopes of proving my innocence utterly at an end. One only chance was left me, that of beseeching the magistrate before whom I was taken to cause every inquiry to be made for an individual named the Abbé Busoni, who had stopped at the inn of the Pont du Gard on the morning previous to the murder. If, indeed, Caderousse had not invented the story relative to the diamond, and that there existed no such person as the Abbé Busoni, in which case I was lost past redemption, or at least my life hung upon the feeble chance of Caderousse himself being apprehended and confessing the whole truth. 2 months passed away in hopeless expectation on my part, while I must do the magistrate justice by declaring he used every means to obtain information of the person I declared could exculpate me if he would. Caderousse still evaded all pursuit, and I had resigned myself to what seemed my inevitable fate. My trial was to come on at the approaching sessions, when on the 8th of September, that is to say, precisely 3 months and 5 days after the events which had perilled my life, the Abbé Busoni, whom I never ventured to believe I should see, presented himself at the prison doors, saying he understood one of the prisoners wished to speak to him. He added that, having learned the particulars of my imprisonment, he hastened to comply with my desire. You may easily imagine with what eagerness I welcomed him and how minutely I related the whole of what I had seen and heard. I felt some degree of nervousness as I entered upon the history of the diamond, but to my inexpressible astonishment he confirmed it in every particular, and to my equal surprise he seemed to place entire belief in all I stated. And then it was that, won by his mild charity, perceiving him acquainted with all the habits and customs of my own country, and considering also that pardon for the only crime of which I was really guilty might come with a double power from lips so benevolent and kind, I besought him to receive my confession, under the seal of which I recounted the affair of Auteuil in all its details, as well as every other transaction of my life. That which I had done by the impulse of my best feelings produced the same effect as though it had been the result of calculation. My voluntary confession of the assassination at Auteuil proved to him that I had not committed that with which I stood accused. When he quitted me, he bade me be of good courage and rely upon his doing all in his power to convince my judges of my innocence. I had speedy proofs that the excellent Abbé was engaged in my behalf, for the rigours of my imprisonment were alleviated by many trifling though acceptable indulgences, and I was told that my trial was to be postponed to the assizes following those now being held. In the interim, it pleased Providence to cause the apprehension of Caderousse, who was discovered in some distant country and brought back to France, where he made a full confession, refusing to make the fact of his wife's having suggested and arranged the murder any excuse for his own guilt. The wretched man was sentenced to the galleys for life, and I immediately set at liberty. "And then it was, I presume," said Monte Cristo, "that you came to me as the bearer of a letter from the Abbé Busoni. It was, Your Excellency. The benevolent Abbé took an evident interest in all that concerned me. 'Your mode of life as a smuggler,' said he to me one day, 'will be the ruin of you if you persist in it. Let me advise you, when you get out of prison, to choose something more safe as well as respectable.' 'But how,' inquired I, 'am I to maintain myself and my poor sister?' 'A person whose confessor I am,' replied he, 'and who entertains a high regard for me, applied to me a short time since to procure him a confidential servant. Would you like such a post? If so, I will give you a letter of introduction to the friend I allude to. With thankfulness shall I profit by your permitting me to wait upon the gentleman you speak of. One thing you must do, swear solemnly that I shall never have reason to repent my recommendation.' I extended my hand and was about to pledge myself by any promise he would dictate, but he stopped me. 'It is unnecessary for you to bind yourself by any vow,' said he. 'I know and admire the Corsican nature too well to fear you. Here, take this,' continued he, after rapidly writing the few lines I brought to Your Excellency, and upon receipt of which you deigned to receive me into your service, 'and I venture most respectfully and humbly to ask whether Your Excellency has ever had cause to repent having done so.'
'On the contrary, Bertuccio, I have ever found you faithful, honest, and deserving.
one fault I find with you, and that is your not having placed sufficient confidence in me. Indeed, Your Excellency, I know not what you mean. Simply this. How comes it that, having both a sister and an adopted son, you have never spoken to me of either? Alas, I have still to recount the most distressing period of my life. Anxious as you may suppose I was to behold and comfort my dear sister, I lost no time in hastening to Corsica. But when I arrived at Rogliano, I found a house of mourning and of desolation, the consequences of a scene so horrible that the neighbours remember and speak of it to this day. Acting by my advice, my poor sister had refused to comply with the unreasonable demands of Benedetto, who was continually tormenting her for money as long as he believed there was a sou left in her possession. One morning that he had demanded money, threatening her with the severest consequences if she did not supply him with what he desired, he disappeared throughout the whole of the day, leaving the kind-hearted Assunta, who loved him as if he were her own child, to weep over his conduct and bewail his absence. Evening came, and still, with all the patient solicitude of a mother, she watched for his return. As the 11th hour struck, he entered with a swaggering air, attended by two of the most dissolute and reckless of his ordinary companions. As poor Assunta rose to clasp her truant in her arms, forgetting all but the happiness of seeing him again, she was seized upon by the three ruffians, while the unnatural Benedetto exclaimed, "Come, if the old girl refuses to tell us where she keeps her money, let us just give her a taste of the torture. That will make her find her tongue. I'll engage." It unfortunately happened that our neighbour Wasilio was at Bastia, leaving no person in his house but his wife. No human creature except she could hear or see anything that took place within our dwelling. Two of the brutal companions of Benedetto held poor Assunta, who, unable to conceive that any harm was intended to her, smiled innocently and kindly in the face of those who were soon to become her tormentors, while the third ruffian proceeded to barricade the doors and windows. Then, returning to his infamous accomplices, the three united in stifling the cries uttered by the poor victim at the sight of these alarming preparations. This effected, they dragged the unoffending object of their barbarity towards the fire, on which they forcibly held her feet, expecting by this diabolical expedient to wring from her where her supposed treasure was secreted. In the struggles made by my poor sister, her clothes caught fire, and her fiendish and cowardly tormentors were compelled to let go their hold in order to preserve themselves from sharing the same fate. Covered with flames, Assunta rushed wildly to the door, but it was fastened. Tortured by the agony she endured, the unfortunate sufferer flew to the windows, but they were also strongly barricaded. Then her cries and shrieks of anguish filled the place. To these succeeded convulsive sobs and deep groans, which, subsiding in faint moans, at length died away. And all was still as the grave. Next morning, as soon as the wife of Wasilio could muster up courage to venture abroad, she caused the door of our dwelling to be opened by the public authorities, when Assunta, though dreadfully burnt, was found still breathing. Every drawer and closet in the house had been forced open, and everything worth carrying off stolen from them. Benedetto never again appeared in Rogliano. Neither have I since that day either seen or heard anything concerning him. It was subsequently to these dreadful events that I waited on Your Excellency, to whom it would have been folly to have mentioned Benedetto, since all traces of him seemed entirely lost, or of my dear sister, since she was dead. "And in what light did you view the tragical occurrence?" inquired Monte Cristo. "As a punishment for the crime I had committed," answered Bertuccio. "Oh, those Villeforts are an accursed race." "Truly they are," murmured the Count, with a most singular expression of countenance. "And now," resumed Bertuccio, "Your Excellency may perhaps be able to comprehend that this place which I revisit for the first time, this garden, the actual scene of my crime,
must have given rise to reflections of no very agreeable nature, and produced that gloom and depression of spirits which excited the notice of your excellency, who was pleased to express a desire to know the cause. At this instant, a shudder passes over me as I reflect that possibly I am now standing on the very grave in which lies Monsieur de Villefort, by whose hand the ground was dug to receive the corpse of his child. It may be so, said Monte Cristo, rising from the bench on which he had been sitting. But, added he, in a lower tone, whether the procureur du roi be dead or not, the Abbé Busoni did right to send you to me. And you have also acted extremely properly in relating to me the whole of your history, as it will prevent my forming any erroneous opinions concerning you in future. As for that Benedetto, who so grossly belied his name, have you never made any effort to trace out whither he has gone, or what has become of him? No. Far from wishing to learn whither he had betaken himself, I should have shunned the possibility of meeting him as I would a wild beast or a savage monster. Thank God I have never heard his name mentioned by any person, and I hope and believe he is dead. Flatter not yourself that such is the case, replied the Count. An all-wise providence permits not sinners to escape thus easily from the punishment they have merited on earth, but reserves them to aid his own designs, using them as instruments whereby to work his vengeance on the guilty. I am content to have him live, continued Bertuccio, so that he spares me the misery of ever again beholding him. And now, Monsieur le Comte, added the steward, bending humbly forward, you know every secret of my life. Bertuccio hid his face in his hands as he uttered these words, while Monte Cristo fixed on him a long and indescribable gaze. After a brief silence, rendered still more solemn by the time and place, the Count said in a tone of melancholy wholly unlike his usual manner, in order to bring this conversation to a fitting termination, as I promise you never again to revert to it, I will repeat to you some words I have heard from the lips of the Abbé Busoni himself, and which I recommend you to treasure up for your consolation. That all earthly ills yield to two all-potent remedies, time and silence. And now leave me. I would enjoy the cool solitude of this place. The very circumstances which inflict on you as a principal in the tragic scene enacted here such painful emotions are to me, on the contrary, a source of extreme delight, and serve but to enhance the value of this dwelling in my estimation. Retire within, Bertuccio, and tranquillize your mind. Should your confessor be less indulgent to you in your dying moments than you found the Abbé Busoni, send for me, if I am still on earth, and I will soothe your ear with words that shall effectually calm and soothe your parting soul. Bertuccio bowed lowly and respectfully and turned away, sighing heavily as he quitted his patron. When he had quite disappeared, Monte Cristo arose, and taking three or four steps onwards, he murmured, "Here, beneath this plane tree, must have been where the infant's grave was dug. There is the little door opening into the garden. At this corner is the private staircase communicating with the sleeping apartment. There will be no necessity for me to make a note of these particulars, for there, before my eyes, beneath my feet, all around me, I have the plan sketched with all the living reality of truth." After making the tour of the garden a second time, the Count regained the house and re-entered his carriage, while Bertuccio, who perceived the thoughtful expression of his master's features, took his seat beside the driver without uttering a word. The carriage proceeded rapidly towards Paris. That same evening, upon reaching his abode in the Champs-Élysées, the Count of Monte Cristo went over the whole building with the air of one long acquainted with each nook or corner. Nor, although preceding the party, did he once mistake one door for another, or commit the smallest error when choosing any particular corridor or staircase to conduct him to a place or suite of rooms he desired to visit.
Ali was his principal attendant during the somewhat late hour of his survey. Having given various orders to Bertuccio relative to the improvements and alterations he desired to make in the house, the Count, drawing out his watch, said to the attentive Nubian, "It is 11:30. Ede will not be long ere she arrives. Have the French attendants been summoned to await her coming?" Ali extended his hands towards the apartments destined for the fair Greek, which were at a distance from the habitable part of the dwelling, and so effectually concealed by means of a tapestried entrance that it would have puzzled the most curious to have divined that beyond that spot lay hid a suite of rooms fitted up with a rich magnificence worthy of the lovely being who was to tenant them. Ali, having pointed to the apartments, counted 3 on the fingers of his right hand, and then, placing it beneath his head, shut his eyes and feigned to sleep. "I understand," said Monte Cristo, well acquainted with Ali's pantomime. "You mean to tell me that 3 female attendants await their new mistress in her sleeping chamber?" Ali, with considerable animation, made a sign in the affirmative. "The young lady must needs be fatigued with her journey," continued Monte Cristo, "and will, no doubt, wish to retire to rest immediately upon her arrival. Desire the French attendants not to weary her with questions, but merely to pay their respectful duty and retire. You will also see that the Greek servant holds no communication with those of this country." Ali bowed obediently and reverentially. Just at that moment, voices were heard hailing the concierge. The gate opened, a carriage rolled down the avenue and stopped at the flight of steps leading to the house. The Count hastily descended and presented himself at the already opened carriage door to assist a young female completely enveloped in a mantle of green and gold to alight. The female raised the hand extended towards her to her lips and kissed it with a mixture of love and respect. Some few words passed between them in that sonorous language in which Homer makes his gods converse. The female spoke with an expression of deep tenderness, while the Count replied with an air of gentle gravity. Preceded by Ali, who carried a rose-coloured flambeau in his hand, the female, who was no other than the lovely Greek who had been Monte Cristo's companion in Italy, was conducted to her apartments, while the Count retired to the pavilion reserved for himself. In another hour, every light in the house was extinguished. 47. Unlimited credit. About 2 o'clock the following day, a calèche, drawn by a pair of magnificent English horses, stopped at the door of Monte Cristo, and a person dressed in a blue coat with buttons of a similar colour, a white waistcoat over which was displayed a massive gold chain, brown trousers, and a quantity of black hair descending so low over his eyebrows as to leave it doubtful whether it were not artificial, so little did its jetty glossiness assimilate with the deep wrinkles stamped on his features, bent forwards from the carriage door, on the panels of which were emblazoned the armorial bearings of a baron, and directed his groom to inquire at the porter's lodge whether the Count of Monte Cristo resided there, and if he were within. While waiting, the occupant of the carriage surveyed the house, the garden, so far as he could distinguish it, and the livery of the servants who passed to and fro, with an attention so close as to be somewhat impertinent. The groom, in obedience to his orders, tapped at the window of the porter's lodge, saying, "Pray, does not the Count of Monte Cristo live here?" "His Excellency does reside here," replied the concierge, "but," added he, glancing an inquiring look at Ali. Ali returned a sign in the negative. "But what?" asked the groom. "His Excellency does not receive visitors today." "Then take my master's card. You'll see who master is, Monsieur le Baron Danglars. Be sure to give the card to the Count and say that, although in haste to attend the chamber, my master came out of his way to have the honour of calling upon him." "I never speak to His Excellency," replied the concierge. "The valet de chambre will carry your message." The groom returned to the carriage. "Well?" asked Danglars. The man, somewhat crestfallen by the rebuke he had received, detailed to his master all that had passed between himself and the concierge. "Bless me," murmured Monsieur le Baron Danglars. This must surely be a prince instead of a count, by their styling him Excellency, and only venturing to address him by the medium of his valet de chambre. However, it does not signify. He has a letter of credit on me, so I must see him when he requires his money. Then, throwing himself back in his carriage, Danglars called out to his coachman in a voice that might be heard across the road, "To the Chamber of Deputies." Apprised in time of the visit paid him, Monte Cristo had from behind the blinds of his pavilion as minutely observed the Baron by means of an excellent lorgnette as Danglars himself had scrutinized the house, garden, and servants. "That fellow has a decidedly bad countenance," said the Count in a tone of disgust as he shut up his glass into its ivory case. "Ali," cried he, striking at the same time on the brazen gong. Ali appeared. "Summon Bertuccio," said the Count.